From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The exploding head in Scanners, the melting Nazi in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the horrible half-human insect in The Fly and The Fly 2. All of those special effects are the work of Chris Wallace. On this edition of Fresh Air, Wallace talks about bringing the horrible, the spectacular, and the impossible to the screen. Also today, best-selling spy novelist Frederick Forsyth tells us about some of the hazards of his profession. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from tuba player Bob Stewart. And television critic David Bianculli reviews a documentary that goes behind the scenes at one of TV's most popular game shows, Jeopardy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. House Energy Committee Chairman John Dingell today cautiously endorsed the Bush administration's clean air bill. At the first congressional hearing on the package, Dingell called the proposal the best vehicle for breaking a decade-long clean air stalemate. The Michigan Democrat lashed out at critics who say the bill gives the administration too much latitude in enforcing environmental regulations. Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher today temporarily suspended rules requiring shrimpers to use devices intended to protect endangered sea turtles. Mosbacher's decision followed weekend protests by shrimpers who blocked shrimp channels along the Texas Gulf Coast. Margaret Thatcher today announced the biggest cabinet reshuffle of her 10 years as British Prime Minister. Details from NPR's Vera Frankel.
Nobody quite knew what to expect of Prime Minister Thatcher's cabinet reshuffle this time round. What was clear was that she'd have to do something radical to halt the alarming slide in her government's popularity. In the event, she's turned her whole cabinet upside down. The biggest bombshell was the removal of Sir Geoffrey Howe from his post as Foreign Secretary. He becomes Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the House of Commons. Taking over from him is a virtual unknown, John Major, a junior minister at the Treasury. His is a classic Thatcherite success story. The son of a circus trapeze artist, he left school at 16 and worked as a laborer before joining a city bank. A less surprising move was the sacking of Transport Secretary Paul Channon. He's presided over a dismal series of air and rail crashes and was bitterly criticized over aviation safety around the time of the Lockerbie disaster last December. This is Vera Frankel in London.
The first day of peace talks aimed at ending the 10-year-old war in Cambodia was marked by some sharp disagreements today. Kathleen Hunt has more from Paris.
Following several hours of discussions, both Prince Sihanouk and pro-Vietnamese Prime Minister Hun Sen expressed their deep differences over the role of the Khmer Rouge in a future coalition government in Phnom Penh. Sihanouk insists that his powerful, if notorious, coalition partner must have a share in a four-party government. But Cambodia's Prime Minister, Hun Sen, told reporters today that Cambodians have been victims of the genocidal policy of former Khmer Rouge leader Pol Pot, and they must be excluded from power sharing. Hun Sen also condemned the United States for its recent decision to send arms to the non-communist Khmer factions who've been fighting the Hanoi troops since they invaded Cambodia 10 years ago. He warned that the American aid can only encourage the outbreak of civil war after the Vietnamese finished their troop withdrawal in September. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 22 points. To close the day at 2584.98, declines led advances 3-2. This is NPR News. The Justice Department today was granted a delay in the Iran-Contra trial of former Costa Rica station chief Joseph Fernandez. Trial was supposed to have begun today, but the CIA wanted to stop Fernandez's lawyers from identifying as part of his defense three CIA programs in Costa Rica and the locations of three CIA stations and facilities in Latin America. Fernandez is accused of lying to cover up his role in the illegal diversion of money to the Nicaraguan Contras. Continuing coal strikes were the subject of a frank televised debate in the Soviet Parliament today, the BBC's Diana Goodman reports.
The debate was intended to be a discussion purely about the miners' strike, but instead it turned into a litany of complaints from the assembled deputies about the pace of change in the Soviet Union. Some speakers claimed that the Soviet people had lost faith in empty promises, and they said the strikes were a symptom of widespread despair. Mr. Gorbachev himself read out a note which had been handed up to him suggesting that the concessions granted to the miners could result in a chain reaction of strikes amongst other workers. But the Soviet leader took the warning in his stride, and once again it seemed clear that he's hoping to turn the sense of frustration in the country to his advantage by using it to prove to his opponents that faster reforms are the only way forward.
Diana Goodman in Moscow. Pro-independence demonstration in Soviet Georgia today stopped almost all commercial activity in the capital of Tbilisi. According to Reuters, some 20,000 flag-waving Georgians marched through the streets chanting, "Down with the Soviet Empire." It was reportedly the biggest demonstration in Tbilisi since April 9th. The Chinese delegation to an international scientific conference walked out today when Soviet physicist Andrei Sakharov called for other nations to condemn China for its bloody crackdown against the pro-democracy movement. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. In the 1986 thriller The Fly, Seth Brundle thought his body sores and decaying extremities were the result of a rare form of cancer, until he realized that he was turning into a fly. The man who turned Seth Brundle from a man into a fly is my guest, special effects director Chris Whalis. In the sequel, Fly 2, Whalis makes his debut as a director. Whalis is responsible for the special effects in many memorable scenes in recent films. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, he made a Nazi's face melt. In Scanners, he created an exploding head. And in Gremlins, he got those nasty little furry creatures to breakdance. The Fly 2 will be out on video next week. It picks up where The Fly left off. The human fly is dead, but his genes live on in the fetus of his pregnant lover. Fly 2 begins in the delivery room. Fly 2 also features many disturbing special effects created by Whalis's company. I asked him how much he personally contributed to the special effects, since this time he was directing.
I didn't work so much on effects, really. I tried to stand back as much as I possibly could. Of course, initially, it was very easy and I think wise for me to just go into my effects company and say, listen, this is what it should be like, and we should make one of these puppets and one of these puppets, and this should be done, you know, mechanically. Gave them sort of groundwork of specifics and then stepped out of the effects end of it and just sort of glanced at what they were doing every once in a while. And, you know, it was quite tough sort of keeping my fists in my pockets, being able to grab onto everything.
And working with the human beings instead of the monsters.
Yeah, you know, it was very difficult for me to function without a lump of clay in my hand. So I have to admit there were a couple of times I failed on the set where I fell back into my old ways and had to paint the blood on or, you know, position the puppet or something.
Well, as a director, you had to come up with a different answer to the question that Fly 1 posed, which was, what would it look like if the genes of a person were crossed with the genes of a fly? Would you describe something of the solution you came up with for the second movie?
Sure. Basically, the premise of the first film was that it was a mistake. It was a biological imbalance. The genes were battling and fighting for control, and neither one was really winning. So it was a very asymmetrical, imbalanced, twisted, and wrong, non-viable creature that was forming. In Fly 2, we have a creature that is born intact, genetically balanced, and with a very solid biological destination. So, you know, in the design sense, it had to be much more of a hint of things to come than in the first film. In the first film, it was a disease, and you didn't really know where it was going. In our film, it really, you know, it's where it's going. I mean, you know from the title Fly 2, a guy's going to turn into a fly. So it was a matter of making sure that it did it nice and clean, nice and sharp, and very directed so the audience could pay attention to the rest of the stuff that was happening in the film.
Do you want to describe the final monster that it turns into?
Sure. I wanted to have something that was a little spectacular. So we've got a nice big tall guy who's got four arms and two legs. Very colorful. I went with some nice fly blues and greens, and it pays, I think, a much more attention to an insect sort of crustacean orientation than the first film. But still, it was very critical that it have enough of a character to its face to be still relatable as the character. So it's still got, you know, two sets of eyes that turn and look and everything else. And, you know, the mouth is very different but still relatable. The proportions of the face are close to human, but pretty different.
Did you study insects before either movie?
Yes and no. In the wider sense, yes, I did, because I've also always been a real nature fan. Since I was a little kid, I was the guy who was always, when everybody else was out on the street playing football or baseball, I was out in the vacant lot turning over old lumber and stones to see what was under them. So I had a real good working knowledge of entomology, and, you know, like I say, I'm an amateur naturalist, so I got a good background.
I read that you also have studied mythology and fairy tales, and I bet that there's a lot of interesting ideas about transformation to get from those stories.
Oh, absolutely. It's, in fact, that's what a lot of this film is about. Our character is, and I think it's one of the great things about the genre, science fiction, horror, and fantasy, are, like, really the few areas that are left in filmmaking where you can sort of go overboard and speak in much broader, larger-than-life terms and still get away with it. And in our film, it's really a story of a person who is born and seems to have absolutely no control over his existence, isn't happy with it, but is incapable of changing it. And it's only through a horribly painful experience that he has a rebirth and has the wherewithal and capabilities to actually take control of his life, which he does in a very twisted, unique way, I think.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Chris Whalis, and he directed the movie Fly 2. It's a sequel to The Fly, for which Chris Whalis did the special effects. His company did the special effects for the sequel. There's a scene in this movie, and I don't think I'll be giving much away to tell this, where there's a man who's squashed by an elevator. Now, the kid in back of me, when that happened, said, "Yeah, two thumbs up," which I thought was a really odd reaction to have. And, of course, I wondered what Siskel and Ebert would have thought of it. But I was wondering if you ever go to movie theaters to just watch how people of different ages respond to the gorier special effects.
Yeah, it's really very interesting, because adults seem much, much less tolerant of it than young people do. And I think that's a matter of the fact that young people don't have as great a sense of their own mortality and the realities of what that grossness is. And adults, you know, accept it on another more conscious level. And the kids are just there to see how far it's all going to go.
Do you want people to see your special effects and think, ooh, gross? Or would you prefer that they go home at night and have nightmares and really be haunted by the images that you've created?
Well, I actually hope it's a little bit of both, because I think I've struck a balance in the film where there are those moments that just hit the audience, and those are the sort of shock effect, gross out moments. And I think they're kept to a minimum. That same the head squash, as you describe it, is only 16 frames long. It's less than 2/3 of a second. It's not something where we paint the screen red from scene one to the end of the film. There are, I think, much more haunting images in the film of the boy who's got to put his dog to death, and the sort of tender moments between what is a human being and what was a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to think that the audience can go home kind of going, God, did you see that guy's head broken? It was disgusting. It was really weird. But, you know, what really got me was when I had to, I actually cried when a guy had to do the deed to his dog. You know, I'm really hoping to it'll hit people on a couple of different levels.
Do you ever edit out things because they're too gruesome?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when you're filming something, it's always wisest to shoot it as extreme as you can possibly do it. You know, just go way over the top, because then at least you have the choice of cutting back or showing the whole thing. And in fact, we cut out a part of the head crush was a little bit longer and actually much more graphic. I mean, if I can speak in very blatant terms, you started seeing what was inside that head a little more clearly. And that wasn't the effect that I was going for. It wasn't that extreme gross out. It was just a shock cut. So I cut that back actually to about a third the length of the shot.
How would that affect the ratings? Are ratings affected by gruesome imagery?
You know, it's very interesting because this head crush is going to be the topic of conversation, I think, for a while, because what actually happened was that was the shot that initially gave us an X rating with the ratings board.
Oh.
And I, you know, I went to him and I said, listen, you know, we've got a guy whose face is melting in five different cuts and it's over, you know, 20 times the length of this head crush. And their problem with the head crush was that it was more of an industrial accident than it was a, you know, a monster on the loose action. And I found that very disturbing because I think the monster on the loose stuff is actually much more vicious and absolutely more graphic. And so what we actually did, we extended the scene before the shot rather than cut the shot tighter. And what we did was we added two more shots of looking up at the elevator coming down, looking at the guy stuck at the bottom. And that just sort of prepared the audience for the shock of it. And they kind of went, yeah, that's great. That's all we wanted.
So the ratings board is sometimes more concerned with very realistic violence than with things they might consider more either cartoonish or fantasy.
Absolutely. It wasn't a matter of how much blood we put on screen. It was a matter of really how well we did it. And their sort of conviction was we sort of did that one a little too mm-hmm. good.
You know, I'm thinking back to early war movies. By early, I even mean, you know, in the 1950s. And you'd see somebody getting slaughtered and there'd be no blood. And that there was a time when blood coming out of a wound was really a taboo on screen. That's certainly no longer the case, but I think there still are taboos on screen.
Well, I think it's you bring up an interesting point because in the old black and white days, actually in the earlier days, you will see blood on screen and you will see some pretty graphic and strong stuff happening. And it was the introduction of color when suddenly blood being red leapt off the screen a little bit stronger than anything else that the true impact started hitting people, and they really tailored back, and they cut back, and as you say, they didn't show anything. You know, cowboys were blasting each other to shreds, and maybe there was a drop of blood coming out of their mouth, and that was it. And, you know, it was only sort of the new freedom of the 60s that allowed people to start pushing it again, and obviously I think it swung a little too far in one way, but it's coming back to more to storytelling. But it is interesting that there's definitely things that go too far. And I think in terms of the ratings board, it's not a matter of specifics all the time either. There are things that are just cumulatively distasteful and don't really, you know, it comes down to that question, what is the redeeming quality about it?
Mm-hmm.
And if there isn't some higher storytelling level or there isn't some good point about it, then it is just wanton bloodshed for no reason. And I think that's what the ratings board and audiences really do object to.
Have you ever used any of your special effects wizardry to play a practical joke on somebody?
Never.
It could be a really horrible practical joke, given the skills that you have.
Yeah, I have to say it's sort of a standard thing that the special effects guys are always responsible for the craziest practical jokes. And we've certainly pulled a few in our time. But, you know, there's always the gags of sticking, you know, liquid smoke in people's windshield wipers and, well, there's all sorts of exploding things all the time, people having their birthday cakes explode and everything else. But in terms of getting really, how shall I say, pushing the joke of it, I'm very leery of that because a lot of people can take it the wrong way very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend not to be one of those guys.
I want to talk with you about some of the memorable scenes that you've done and how you did them. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Chris Whalis, and he was the special effects director for The Fly, and he directed the sequel, Fly 2. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, Chris Whalis, is the head of his own special effects company. Let's talk about some of the scenes that you've done for movies over the years and how you did them. I think one very memorable image that I'm sure most of our audience has seen was in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Nazi whose face melts.
Right. That was one of the most difficult jobs I ever had to do, as a matter of fact. It was something that came as a surprise to me. I was working at Lucasfilm on another project, and Raiders sort of came in, and George originally was just going to blow up everybody's head at the end, and I kind of said, can't you do something a little more interesting and have some fun? And he said, sure, whatever. So we came up with melting this guy's head, which, you know, at first sounded like a great idea, and then when I sat down and thought about it, and the restrictions that George had, he had just a few seconds to do this in, and it's very difficult to find things that are going to melt that quickly and controllably. So what happened was I wound up having to construct a plaster underskull, actually a stone underskull, and formulate a gelatin, almost a household gelatin, in separate layers and different colors, and put in all sorts of yarn and string and rubber bits and eyeballs and hair and everything else on a very, very delicate piece of work to get in front of the camera, and so that as it melted, it would obviously not just turn red and you know, and stop. I needed something that was going to keep the audience engaged a little bit more. So it goes through a lot of colors and everything else. And what happened was we basically stuck it in front of the camera. We shot it with a little bit of time lapse. I can't remember what the exact speed was, but the whole melting took about 10 minutes, and we got it down to about, I don't know, a couple of seconds, actually. And I had two big air heaters, basically giant flames with fans behind them, blowing on this thing, melting it in front of the camera. And I was about 2 inches out of frame underneath with a hairdryer, you know, making sure it melted evenly and everything balanced out. And I had to mechanize things like the glasses and the eyeballs and things like that so that I could control them moving slowly so that they just didn't pop all over the frame.
And you were lucky enough to get this on the first take, I hope?
On the first take, yes, but that's also given the fact that we did about 20 tests ahead of time to make sure we had our timing down and all the colors right.
Now, in The Fly, in the first version of The Fly, there's a very disturbing scene where Jeff Goldblum as The Fly is showing his girlfriend, played by Gina Davis, what's become of him, and he takes a donut and he throws up on the donut because it's this enzyme that flies use to predigest their food, and then he scratches his ear and his ear falls off.
Right.
And it's really very, very, very disturbing. Were you responsible for those effects?
Yeah, of course it was a massive effort, and a lot of people worked on it, and Stefan Dupuis was sort of my head makeup man, was really the one who finally engineered that. And that was pretty tough because we had to sort of really tape Jeff Goldblum's ears back pretty tightly and then put on a sort of a false wig, a false ear, and get some little tubes in there so little bits of goo dripped out. And there was just a little string that at the right moment got pulled and the ear fell off.
What got you so interested in doing special effects? Did you watch a lot of monster movies, horror movies as a kid?
That's really what did it. I started out as a real monster fan. I loved all the old Universal Pictures, all the old Silence and Godzilla and King Kong, and I really thrived on them, the old Ray Harryhausen movies, Sinbad and everything else. And obviously, as a little kid, wanted to relive those moments as much as possible. I didn't have a camera to make my own films, but I did have a bunch of clay to sort of make my own characters. So I literally used to sculpt up the monsters and the heroes and have little fights with each other, and it all sort of stemmed from there. And as it grew, I started doing makeup a little bit, very, very poorly, you know, in the neighborhood.
Who would you make up?
I was the only one for a long time that I could find that would sit still. So I wound up making myself up most of the time, and it was always horrible mutants and hunchbacks and all sorts of scar-faced things. And my mother got used to it pretty quickly. There were one or two times when I came barreling down the stairs with a bloody, torn-open leg that I think I got her, but most of the time she was pretty immune to it.
How did you break into doing special effects for movies?
It was interesting. Well, I always thought it was interesting. Anyway, I was going to school at L.A. City College to pick up a couple of filmmaking classes. And surprisingly enough, I, as a starving student, ran completely out of money and had to take a job. I took a job at a Halloween mask-making company where I learned how to paint and a little bit of sculpting and molding and some of the very, very basics of this kind of stuff. And that company occasionally worked on like a TV commercial, a TV show, something like that. And I worked my way into their lab, and that's where you got to do that stuff. So I started there, worked on a couple of pictures, and then one day a guy named John Berg came in, and he was doing the special effects on a Joe Dante picture called Piranha. And, you know, he was just looking around to see what the facilities were, if it was would be wise to try and make the rubber fish there, which it wasn't, but he did say, well, you want to work on a movie, kid? And I was like, you know, big-eyed, you know, stars in my eyes, kid going, oh, yes, I'd love to do that. And that was my introduction. That was my first real on-set experience of incredible underwater, arduous workouts and long, long days at New World Pictures. But it was a great experience and a great introduction to film.
Do you have a favorite outtake from any of the monster-type shots that you've worked on?
Oh, that's a good question. That is a good question. I think there were probably about 18,000 of them from Gremlins. We shot a tremendous amount of footage, an awful lot of gags, and we did a ton of stuff in the tavern sequence that's not in there. And I don't know if there's any favorites, but there's a lot of Gremlins flying through the air and smashing into walls that I remember fondly.
Mm-hmm. Have you, like, shopped butcher shops for blood and guts for movies?
I have to say I've never done that. I'm one of those people who's a little too squeamish to handle that.
Oh, come on.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely the case. I, you know, it's one thing, and
you can dish it out, but you can't take it, huh?
Yeah, you said it, and it's really interesting because I can, you know, I can pour as much blood on the screen as the next guy. And I watch the films that I've done it in, and I'm immune to it. But I watch somebody else's film, and I'll tell you, that knife goes to the throat or the wrist, and I just can't look.
Without giving away too much about Fly 2, I can say with confidence that the way it ends, there could be another sequel.
I think you have every justification to say that with confidence. Yeah, it's a real strong possibility. The thing about Fly 2 was it opened not just a franchise on another, you know, Friday the 13th or Freddy or something, but it's a new premise for trying out a lot of different ideas and concepts. The teleportation aspect is just, it's almost limitless in its possibilities of what can be done with it. There, in Fly 2, early on, we went through 30 or 40 different premises that were all intriguing and, you know, each one was completely different from the others. So my hope is there will be another Fly 3 and it will be completely different from Fly 1 and completely different from Fly 2.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about some of your movies. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Chris Willis's movie Fly 2 will be out on video next week. I'm Terry Gross and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actor Avery Brooks. He played tough guy Hawk on the series Spencer for Hire and got his own spin-off series afterwards. And on stage, he starred in an opera about Malcolm X and starred in a one-man show about Paul Robeson. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The heroes in Frederick Forsyth's spy novels often go undercover to get the information they need. Frederick Forsyth does that too. Coming up, the author of The Day of the Jackal, The Odessa File, and The Negotiator tells us about talking to spies, getting caught by illegal arms dealers, and being awakened by the sound of gunfire. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Bob Stewart, one of today's most versatile tuba players. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the latest installment of Public Television's documentary series POV. This week, it goes behind the scenes of a TV game show and follows the contestants of Jeopardy's Tournament of Champions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. President Bush says he's upset by the spying allegations against U.S. diplomat Felix Bloch, but the president says he doesn't want to comment on the charges until all the facts are in. While Bloch has not been arrested, law enforcement officials are keeping close tabs on his whereabouts. President Bush's Clean Air Bill received its first congressional scrutiny today, with Democrats in both houses expressing disappointment. They say the bill falls short of promises Bush made in June and in some cases weakens current clean air standards. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The majority leader of the Senate, George Mitchell, applauded the president for making any proposal at all to improve the nation's air quality. But he said, on balance, the bill was timid and weak. He praised the president's proposals to curb acid rain, but he and others criticized the White House approach to auto emissions and toxic pollutants. The president proposes new, tougher standards for autos, but then critics say it negates those new standards by permitting automakers to meet the standards by measuring the average pollution of fleets of cars, rather than the pollution caused by individual cars. In the area of toxic air pollutants, critics say the bill gives the EPA too much discretion, discretion that the agency has used in the past to ignore polluters. In a hearing before a House Environmental Subcommittee today, the EPA Secretary William Riley asked the committee to assume that this president really cares about clean air. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
The town of Kennebunkport, Maine, has sent a letter to President Bush saying it can no longer afford to provide local police protection during presidential visits. Scott Hood of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network reports.
Kennebunkport town manager Jane Duncan says it was the most difficult letter she's ever written. In the letter to President Bush, White House Chief of Staff John Sununu, and to Maine's congressional delegation, Duncan explains that the town won't provide local police protection during the president's planned three-week visit to his Kennebunkport summer home in August. Local police estimate that presidential visits cost the town $1,500 a day. So far this year, Kennebunkport has spent $15,000 on presidential security, taking the money from a $50,000 contingency fund. Duncan says from now on, the federal government will have to pick up the full security tab. A spokesperson for the Secret Service says assistance from local police would be sorely missed, but that with or without local help, the job of protecting the president will still get done. For National Public Radio, this is Scott Hood in Portland, Maine.
On the heels of weekend protests by angry shrimpers along the Texas Gulf Coast, Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher today temporarily suspended a shrimping regulation. The rule was to require shrimpers to use a new device in their nets intended to keep endangered sea turtles from getting entangled and dying. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 22.38 points today to close at 2584.98. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Bob Stewart is a jazz tuba player whose work shows his diversity and the potential diversity of his instrument. His first professional job in New York was playing Dixieland in the 1960s. A few years later, he was part of a tuba quartet that recorded behind singer Taj Mahal at the Fillmore East. Stewart has also played in the big bands of Carla Bley, Gil Evans, Dizzy Gillespie, and Mujal Richard Abrams. And he's recorded 9 albums as a member of saxophonist Arthur Blythe's quintet. Currently, he plays with trumpeter Les DeBowie's Nonet Brass Fantasy. Stewart has just released a new album with his quintet, the First Line Band, called Goin' Home. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
We'll be right back. Bob Stewart finds a place for the tuba in nearly every corner of American music. He's played everything. Dixieland, blues, swing, bebop, Latin, funk, free jazz, free bop, and space-age brass band music. In a way, Stewart's versatility has been his undoing. He's been on the scene for 2 decades, but put off making his own records until a couple of years ago, because he wasn't sure which direction to take. Finally, he decided to do a little of everything. For instance, on Goin' Home, his second album for the JMT label, Stewart's quintet mixes the Dixieland warhorse Sweet Georgia Brown with a couple of bebop tunes based on it, like Jackie McLean's Donna. That sort of generic jumbling is typical of Bob Stewart. He stresses that the tuba is a world instrument, heard everywhere from New Orleans parades to German polka bands to West African funeral processions. But sometimes the way the tuba gets around surprises even him. Stewart got a shock a few years ago when he heard some traditional music from the country of Suriname on South America's northern hump. The tuba bass parts sounded eerily like something he'd play himself. Here's a Surinamese band playing a folk tune called Sugar Finger. On Stewart's version of Sugar Finger, his tuba alternates between playing the bass part and the melody line. The other brass players are James Zoller on trumpet and Steve Turay on trombone. Traditions remain strong around the world, but the big horn lost its foothold in jazz in the 1920s, when the string bass replaced it in most bands. String bassists were simply more flexible than tuba players. But Bob Stewart aims to prove the tuba can be as nimble as any bass instrument, and borrows good ideas wherever he finds them. Stewart's composition, Tunk, takes as its melody pianist Thelonious Monk's left-hand bass line from his tune Bemsha Swing, a bass line which is usually hard to hear on Monk's versions. Here's a little of how Monk played it. Stewart starts with Monk's bass line and builds a new tune from the ground up. Thank you. The guitarist there is Jerome Harris, whose biting string sound makes him a good foil for the leader. Records that skip around from one genre to another, the way Stewart's does, tend to fall flat. Often that's because the musicians spread themselves too thin. Bob Stewart pulls it off with his new album, precisely by proving what he set out to prove, that the tuba's not half as limited as some folks may think.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the new album Going Home from Bob Stewart and his First Line Band on the JMT label. Here's more of Stewart's version of the traditional sugar finger. This is Fresh Air. Frederick Forsyth is one of the world's best-selling spy novelists. His books include The Day of the Jackal, The Odessa File, The Dogs of War, and The Fourth Protocol. His current bestseller is titled The Negotiator. The main character, Quinn, is the world's best hostage negotiator. He's called in out of retirement when the son of the President of the United States is kidnapped. The kidnapping occurs on the eve of the signing of a major disarmament treaty between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The action takes place in the early 1990s, when Glasnost has been in place for a few years. Forsyth told me that in the era of Glasnost, he's had to rethink who the bad guys are.
The thriller writers have, for a long time now, been able to use the Cold War as a backdrop, and the bad guys were always the KGB. Nobody argued, you know, with how nasty the KGB was, etc. I don't think the KGB is necessarily changing. But I do think the public perception in the West is going to be that Gorb is a nice guy. Well, actually, he's not a pussycat. He's a tough operator. But, you know, at least we're getting on better with him than we ever could with Andropov or Brezhnev. And therefore, the slagging off the Soviet Union may be something of the past. For popular writers, therefore, it may be a question of looking out, yeah, for new bad guys. And actually, in this new book, I have used the ultra-right as the bad guys this time.
No, you mentioned Gorbachev. He's actually a character in your book.
Yeah, I bring him in as himself and Margaret Thatcher. But the American president is fictional. John J. Cormack does not exist, of course.
Are there any legal considerations when you bring in a real character, even someone of the stature of Thatcher or Gorbachev?
Well, I've done it before. Charles de Gaulle featured, obviously, in Day of the Jackal, and it's perfectly feasible to do it. You don't have to ask permission. When a person is a public figure, they've run for public office, they're hardly shrinking violets. Providing you don't libel them or defame them, there's nothing they can really do about it. And if you're going to put in a president as a kind of a walk-on figure, I would never make a main central character somebody like President Bush. That's why I have a President Cormack, who is fictional, because he's a much bigger role. But where one has a walk-on, like 10-minute cameo, there's no harm in using the real person. The only time I really slagged somebody off badly, who was real, was Edward Rushman, the Nazi, in The Odessa File. Because I took the view that if he wanted to come back from Argentina and sue me, he was welcome, because they were going to pick him up for war crimes anyway. So.
That's very clever, actually.
So he didn't show, needless to say.
I think readers always assume that any writer of espionage fiction knows people on the inside of the CIA and MI5. Do you have contacts inside?
Well, you know, one knows the odd chap who perhaps once might have worked at Langley.
Well, that's vague enough. I guess you have to come up with good vague answers to give to when people ask you that.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things about writing this kind of stuff is that I can't get it unless people will talk to me. And talk to me off the record and talk to me about stuff that maybe has never appeared before in books. And they'll only do that if they're absolutely certain I'm not going to blow them away later. So, yes, I do have very good contacts, but I never mention who they are.
I want to ask you a few questions about your work before you started writing fiction. At the age of 17, you left home to be a bullfighter in Spain, which I thought was a pretty unusual fantasy. How far did you get, and why did you have that aspiration?
Well, first of all, not very far. My parents discovered and came down a bit sharpish. I had read a book called Death in the Afternoon by Ernest Hemingway, which was a classic. And I never fought a bull because, one, they're very, very expensive animals, and the kids just used to sign on and pay a little fee to this gimpy old matador who'd taken one horn too many, and he used to teach us the cape work, and it was fun. It was the spring of 56, a very innocent age.
Now, you became a journalist, worked as a journalist for over 10 years.
12 years, yeah.
Uh-huh. Who did you write for?
I started with a provincial newspaper. I didn't get out of the country for 3 years. Then I joined Reuters, the international news agency, and they sent me all over Paris. Actually, Paris, you see, when the OAS were trying to kill Charles de Gaulle, they gave me the seed of the idea for the Day of the Jackal.
Mm-hmm.
And then East Germany. I ran East Germany in the days when it really was fraught. You know, the tanks were gun to gun, muzzle to muzzle on Checkpoint Charlie. We thought maybe the Third World War would start there. And that was good fun.
You were stationed in East Germany for
a
while, not far from the Berlin Wall.
No, it was close to the Berlin Wall. I could hear the machine guns at night when they used to cut down the guys trying to get over the wall.
How did that affect the fiction that you later wrote?
Well, my time in Germany gave me the idea of the Nazi story, the Odessa. I first heard of the Odessa while I was in Germany, this ex-SS organization. And that gave me the idea years later. See, I store things up like a squirrel. I get little bits of information. I shove them away. I may not use them for years, but they're there somewhere. And I stored it up until eventually, 1971, I wrote the Odessa file.
Mm-hmm. You were stationed in Africa for a while as a journalist.
Yeah.
And you covered the Biafran War
in
the late 60s.
Yeah.
But I think you got into a big dispute about your coverage of
the BBC. Well, I'd left Reuters, you see, and joined the BBC, and up came the Biafra War. So they said, you know, would you go and cover the rebel side for us? And I said, I do Europe, remember? Europe and the Middle East. I don't do Africa, Black Africa. They said, well, go on. It's only going to last 10 days. So 2.5 years later, I came back. It was a long war. But I did, in the meantime, quit because I just felt they didn't want to cover it. The establishment didn't want to know what was going on down there. They were more interested in Vietnam. It was a nice American snafu.
How did you switch from journalism to fiction writing?
Fluke, coincidence. I came back in late December 1969, broke, tagged, several black marks against me. I had time on my hands, no commission, no work, no apartment, no car. I was crashing down on the settee of a friend in a friend's apartment. I thought, I've got time to kill, I might as well write this story. The Jackal, the assassin who tried to kill Charles de Gaulle. And so I wrote it. I dashed it off in 35 days. And then I just hawked it around town, and somebody bought it. And to my great amazement, instead of making $50, $100, $200,000, whatever, it became a big one. So it seemed the place to go. Obviously, I was going to be paid more to write fiction than ever writing facts.
Straighten out something for me. I read that in, I think it was 1978, the London Times accused you of raising funds to hire a mercenary army to oust a dictator in Equatorial Guinea. And this was to provide a homeland for displaced Biafrans. And they said that you had raised $200,000 in ammunition, supplies, and salaries for mercenaries, and implied that this might have been for research in how to fund a coup, research that you needed to write a novel.
Hell of a research, isn't it?
So what's the story with it?
The story is that's what they printed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great story. I loved it. Sold a lot of copies, too. But as to how I really researched the dogs of war, no, it's a nice idea, but it wasn't that complicated. I did move around the arms trafficking business. I did move around mercenaries. I needed it for the book, but the rest's a nice story.
How do you move around a secret world like that?
With great difficulty and very carefully, in my case. I think I got my head blown off on that one.
How?
Well, the arms traffickers were rather dangerous guys, and they all had bodyguards. And I got in by posing as a South African, which explained how I spoke German, but with an accent. And so I was attending conferences that purported to be about buying a package of weapons to find out how it was done, how end-user certificates were forged, how illegal arms shipments, you know, got to terrorists and mercenaries and other people. And that was fine, except that one particular day, one of these arms dealers was driving past a bookstore and a book had fallen over and on the back cover was my face. And
oh, gosh.
Whoops-a-daisy. So I left Hamburg in about 14 minutes flat. It was just my bad luck. They launched the Day of the Jackal German edition while I was there. And there was this big display and, you know, it didn't mean anything to this guy. His car stopped on a red light. He was sitting behind the glass, staring across the sidewalk at this big window display. And someone sort of came and nudged a book, and it fell over. And there was the South African who was dealing with him over an arms purchase, staring at him. And he realized it was an investigative reporter. He nearly went bananas.
Well, was that the last time that you went undercover, so to speak, to research a story?
Yeah, I have occasionally offered somebody a name that wasn't entirely my own. But only bad guys, I assure you, only bad guys.
Frederick Forsyth's latest spy novel, The Negotiator, is now in its 13th week on the New York Times bestseller list. The Negotiator is published by Bantam Books. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be telling you about what's happening in Tokyo, where Prime Minister Sosuke Uno has stepped down following the electoral defeat, the first big national election defeat for the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan ever. We'll also be hearing about the Mexican debt agreement reached between Mexico and commercial banks. Tom Gelton reports from Mexico City on that. Also, Linda Wertheimer on the race for the governor of New Jersey and how one issue is figuring very prominently, that the issue is abortion. And it has heated up, obviously, since the Webster decision by the Supreme Court, which gave states power to restrict women's access to abortion.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. POV is film shorthand for point of view. It's also the name of a series of independent documentaries currently running on public television. One of two documentaries that will be shown this week is called Wise Guy. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
The category is TV game shows. The answer is the most intelligent and entertaining game show on television today. You have a few seconds to come up with the proper question. Okay, contestant number one, let's see. You have, what is the Wheel of Fortune? Give me a break. Buy a vowel, take a copy of our home game, and get out of here. Contestant number two, you have, what is couch potatoes? No, sorry. Remember, the answer asked for the most intelligent and entertaining game show, not the least. Contestant number three, you're our last hope. What is Jeopardy? You're absolutely right. And you'll be progressing to our Tournament of Champions, where the best Jeopardy players compete against each other for $100,000 and national bragging rights. I'm guessing here, but I imagine that public radio listeners and Jeopardy fans are a pretty tight fit. So maybe you'll be as intrigued as I was by the idea behind Wise Guys. It's a behind-the-scenes look at a Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions show, following the contestants before, during, and after their championship bouts. Director David Hartwell, who was a film student at USC when he made this documentary, lets us know some of these wise guys pretty well. One's a former drug addict, another's a trivia expert, and one's an arrogant young law student who lectures on the state of public education while strutting down the backstage Jeopardy! Corridor.
I think so. I think people should learn more factual knowledge. You know, people seem to think they can get by with just kind of, knowing where to look things up. But I think you got to have a grounding in this kind of thing. You know, that's why I think that the questions on Jeopardy! Are the kind of things that most people really should know. I mean, I'm not saying you should know them all, but they should at least be aware of what the possible answers are.
Hartwell treats these contestants like professional athletes. He asks about their pregame superstitions, their hopes and dreams, their preparations, and how they sum up their opponents. Most of the champions fear Chuck Forrest, that arrogant young law student, and with good reason. Jeopardy! Host Alex Trebek calls him probably the best contestant to ever play the game, and when he's one of the three players in a given round, Chuck is always right in there.
Only material occurring in nature that is readily fissionable is an isotope of this. Chuck.
What is uranium?
That is it.
In the documentary's best sequence, Hartwell edits out everything but the contestants' answers, or rather, their questions. It's a funny segment made even funnier by the dominance of the legendary Chuck.
Chuck.
What is a canter?
Chuck.
Who is Dr. Doolittle?
Chuck.
What is Brogue?
Chuck.
What is the Forest of Arden?
Chuck.
What is smoke?
Correct. Marvin.
What are the babies?
That's it. Chuck.
Who is Walter Payton?
Chuck.
Who is Harriet Beecher Stowe?
Chuck.
Who is Renee?
You want drama? Watch Wise Guys to see if one of these trivia Davids can topple Chuck's information Goliath. Feel the thrill of victory and the agony of risking everything on a daily double only to lose when you don't phrase the correct answer in the form of a question. And now, it's time for Final Jeopardy. The answer is Wise Guys. What's the question? What's a fun documentary to watch on TV this week?
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Our senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects a lot of the music you hear on the show. Engineering this week are Audrey Vublaitis, Richard Parker, Dan Lachlan, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Avery Brooks. On TV, he's well known as the action hero Hawk, but in the theater, he's had starring roles in an opera about Malcolm X and a one-man show about Paul Robeson. Also, poet and essayist John Haynes talks about his decades in the Alaskan wilderness. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.